A63, number 11B.
Yes?
John Dorley, the first one who called it the law of creativity?
No, he never called it the law of creativity.
Who's the first one to do that, you?
I think I was it, yes. He always just called it the days of creation and said that it is an irresistible order. But naturally what it was, it's the Genesis process. So the naming of it is not so important. But what is of great importance is to see that when, as we see, an age is ready to perceive a new idea, this is a new idea because up to that point, nobody in the realm of the Christian science field would ever have thought that there exists a law of creativity or a law that would show an ordered sequence from the initial idea in mind up to its fulfillment in love. So, I tried to give you one or the other example how in the earliest stages the world has picked up that idea of creativity and how they tried to find out the steps that are necessary in order to be creative in any field. It is perhaps interesting to say that my first encounter with that law of creativity in the world was here in America. A little booklet, I think that Bill Cox once sent me, a booklet that I think is out of print, I think can no more be had. When was it, round about, in the end of 50s, beginning of 60s?
It came out, was copyrighted in 1940, and I think I sent it over in the beginning of the 60s.
In the beginning of 60s, well, round about that time. It was an interesting little booklet, just a few pages, by a man called James Webb Young, and he was an advertising agent, executive. And he tells us in that little booklet that he was very successful in the advertising business and that his friends would come along and say, how do you do it? You always get new ideas. How do you do it? We never get these new ideas as you do. And so he tells us that he then began to think about it himself, that he said, I don't know what I do. They come to me. But he was then investigating his own mind, his own thinking steps, and began to analyze what actually has been doing in order to be productive and to bring forth new ideas. And so when he had analyzed his own mind and has found that he is going through various definite steps, he gave then, I think, once a talk in one of these advertising meetings or so, and then printed it. It's a little booklet, and it's quite interesting that he can see that he says that to get new ideas is the result of a long series of unseen idea-building processes. It's a long series of unseen idea-building processes. And therefore, what is that unseen, that long series? How could he identify these various steps? He said that underlying it, he could see that really an idea is always a new combination of old elements, which we know. But really at the point of life where we always get new ideas, that we see it is actually not new, but it is just a restructuring of the system, of the principle, and therefore every time we restructure it, something new comes out. And so he says, this depends on the ability to see relationships, Again, you can see he rests on the principle, sees if I have the facts of principle, then the rearrangement and seeing new relationship in something really brings about a new idea, an innovation, a discovery, an invention, or whatever it is. We know that there is nothing new under the sun. All that there is all that we find has always existed, but we were not aware of it because we could not see clearly. Why couldn't we see clearly? Because we would not see the relationships. So like in chemistry, if we produce a new chemical product, it's nothing else but a new combination of existing elements. And so it's just a matter of perceiving the relationships of these elements, and then you have the new product. So we do not produce something new, we only see new relationships. And that is what he has seen. And so a new relationship, he says, results in a new idea. But the point naturally which intrigued me was the method that he showed. Actually in his booklet he says that there are five steps. But when we analyze and read along his text that he has given as a lecture, and he has not been a writer, when we analyze it we see that actually he gives seven steps. He has taken in two cases two steps together as one step, but we with the spiritual sense can easily detect that actually he has given seven steps. And so I want quickly go through those seven steps, and we perhaps can detect that he follows the same line of creativity. Point one is, he says, first you have to gather its raw material, getting an intimate knowledge of the elements. And you see, he starts again out with mind, first to get an intimate knowledge of the raw material. With raw material actually means of the facts he has for his subject. Can you see this as mind? As a second point, and this has actually two points in it, so I'm going to number the seven as he goes along, not the way he numbers them. As a second point, he says, we must masticating these materials in the mind. That's a terrific expression, masticate. You know, we would call it pondering. Spirit, in spirit we begin to ponder, you see, our ideas. He says masticating, we ponder it, listening for the meaning. Can you see what we said? In spirit we are at the second stage, we are listening for its meaning. We turn it over in our mind, say, what does it mean? What does it not mean? And so on. And we constantly masticate these ideas. And so we listen for the meaning, which, he says, result really first that little tentative or partial ideas come to you. That's naturally what happens, that in that masticating period where you sort out things, you see, what is right, what is not right, sorting out what applies to my project, what does not apply to my project, you begin to sort out, and by sorting out somehow a little bit seems to appear and a little tentative ideas come to you. Then he shows as a third stage quite an interesting point, which perhaps at the first moment we don't understand. Because in the third stage we would say, well, then things become definite. They gather identity. And he has the very opposite. And perhaps later on we see that this is quite good. He says, after a while you reach the hopeless stage. And I think we too experience that. That we, after a while, we come to the wilderness stage, the third. It seems hopeless. Where it seems that things don't click, that things don't crystallize yet. But that is naturally only because he views it from a human standpoint. And from a human standpoint, it doesn't make click at that point. Then he comes to a fourth point and says, again an interesting point, because it's from the human standpoint. Drop the whole subject and put the problem out of your mind as completely as you can. That comes the positive sense of it. And let it work while you sleep. Isn't that wonderful? No. There is somewhere in the Bible a wording which I don't know now right away English. We have the saying to God, God gives his treasures to the to his loved one in sleep, or something like that, if I translate it. That great point, let it work while you sleep, which means when you put your whole ego, your whole person out of the way. And when you don't interfere with it, then principle can work. Then we give principle a chance to work. The unconscious mind does the synthesis. Isn't that nice? That's the synthesis. We know in principle, in the fourth state, that we need to see each idea in its relationship, in its system, as a synthesizing of something. And so he says, well, that is the important point where the personal sense is out of the picture, and where the unconscious takes over, where we no more consciously interfere with the natural development of an idea. This always reminds me when I read about great discoverer, when they tell how they have discovered things. You read so often that these great discoverer have seen the solution either in a dream, or while they were sleeping, or at the point where they were between sleep and awakening, in that transitional stage where they are not yet quite here, and no more quite there, that then the solution was shown. Think of dear old Agassiz, which Mrs. Eddy quotes. He is well known for that very thing, that he always saw the solution in his dreams, when he woke up, he couldn't remember anymore. He only knew he had seen the solution, but he never remembered what the solution was. So he made himself a discipline that if he would dream again, that the first thing he would remember is to wake up and make a note. And so that's what he did, and that he would wake up and make a note or go right down and fix it. So this is something that so many people say. You know, for instance, Kekele, that saw the whole thing in a dream, where he was dreaming how a serpent or a snake was biting its own tail, and so therefore he could see that the chemical representation of the benzol formula must be a ring and not a sequence as chemistry had it before. He made a terrific discovery of the benzol ring. And that was going on in his consciousness as, you know, a ring like that, you know, perhaps a little bit about it. And it was shown to him by a serpent who was biting itself in its own tail. And these ways of discovery are well known in the field of science. But when the unconscious takes over and the consciousness, the human consciousness, does not interfere, that we give to the reality of things a chance to show themselves forth, to picture themselves forth, to illustrate them in one way or the other.
A point that might be of interest here, since you mentioned Agassiz and that particular point that you were bringing out there, by that method he discovered a previously unknown prehistoric fish in a stone that he could not see in a dream, and sketched it in the dark in complete detail, and the next day went to his laboratory and broke open the fossil he had, and there it was.
Yes, that was, that was the story. And there are books that just tell you over pages and pages similar stories about all the discovery. So here we have a sense of principle. Perhaps you are wondering about the third stage, that hopeless stage, where we said that you reach a hopeless stage. Well, that's naturally that hopeless stage of the wilderness period, where something wants to crystallize itself and we are still stand too much in the way. And therefore it cannot crystallize itself, though it wants to crystallize itself, and therefore that fourth step is necessary, you see, to put it out of the conscious human mind and let the unconscious solution have a chance to manifest itself. Then it goes further to a fifth point. Then he says, then, out of nowhere, the idea will appear. See, the idea will appear. It's the fifth day, the newness of life. Now suddenly the new idea stands out in its individuality. It's the state of the Eureka state. I got it. You know, Eureka, the Greek expression, I have it, I found it. Archimedes was the one who, you know, when he found it, he said, Eureka, I got it. It's that state where it clicks. He takes in a sixth stage and says, now take the new idea out into the world. Take it now out into the world, into the universe. We have seen that too in the sixth stage. That we have to see that if we have found an idea, that we don't say, now I got it. Or we limit it, we have to go to the sixth day and say, it is a part of a bigger whole. So put it back into the bigger whole, into the universe, into the world. He said it needs patient working over to adapt it to the practical exigencies, to practical usefulness. Very nice for the dominion of the sixth day, that you take it in the world, you adapt it to the world so that it can be proved in a practical way and can be useful. Then the seventh stage, he says, a good idea has self-expanding qualities. New possibilities come to light. He sees as a seventh stage that this is not the end of it, that the fulfilled point is that it triggers off again new ideas. So that we can see how, so to say, the seventh stone always reaches an eighth stone, which tone, the octave, that it triggers off again a new creative ability. That with every new innovation, with every new idea we got, we have really a new basis for, again, further innovation. Yes. Did you see a parallel? This is now just from a man who empirically just could analyze his his ability to produce new ideas. I will give you another example that is more from the academic field of, from American scientists, from two men that worked together on creativity, a man called Hutchinson, and the other man was called Ott, O-T-T. So Hutchinson and Ott published their findings of creativity rather early, 1949, and then again something in 1955. You see, it's already quite old, and therefore what has happened in the last 20 years is a terrific literature that has come out from various quarters of the academic field. So that it is already at our disposal quite a big literature. But all those literature, whatever we consider, somehow they always come back to the seventh. It seems that all, from all kinds of ways and means, and for all kinds of application, whatever it is applied, if it's applied of how to make a plan in architecture, or how it is applied to management, or so, always, naturally, it differs in the wording, because the field of application is different, just as our wording, say, in the third degree is different than in the days of creation, or in that order of law or the rule system, but it is always the same flow. Let me go through those seven stages that Hutchinson and Ott began to see, and they said that the general process of scientific creative activity goes through the following stages. So they speak about the scientific creative ability. The first stage is putting the right question, finding the real problem. Very important point, see? Again, is about the right question, which we know is turning to the divine mind that knows all. It shows that if we ask wrong questions, that we never get anywhere. And that is the very first thing. And very often a difficult point, that we can ask the right question about a problem. Then, as a second point, they say, comes the preparatory work. The preparatory work, namely the ordering of the material. And you see again spirit that begins to order, to sort out the material. You begin already to sort out the material and say, well, this point has something to do with this problem, that point has nothing to do with this problem. And you sift and sort out, spirit diversifies, classifies, individualizes, you begin to sort out your notes, whatever you know, whatever facts you know on that subject, you sort them out, and so you have an ordering process. As a third stage, again, they say something similar to what we had in James Webb Young's proposition, namely frustration, disappointment, that the problem doesn't seem to solve itself. Have a similar wilderness experience. You somehow come to the wilderness experience. Huh? Jesus, in the third period, went through the wilderness and had to face that wilderness experience. And then he says, don't give in, you see, and you have to be a sticker. So is perseverance and you have not to give in. Then, fourth, comes the time of incubation. Again they say, like we had before, the problem is at rest. Human thinking is at rest. the it works. The unconscious, the it, begins to work. Again, putting Mary out of the way, putting personal sense out of the way, just like we had it before. Then comes the fifth stage, namely the intuition or enlightenment. Surprises happen. Again, the eureka. And comes that stage of enlightenment, of surprise, the eureka state. The sixth point is, again, like we had before, verification of the new insight. You verify it. You see, does it really work? Is it really a real discovery? You try to apply it to various situations and see, does it work? So you verify it. And seventh, again, very interesting, that universal sense, namely communication of the results. You make it universal. You don't keep it for yourself, but you give it to the world. So, with these two examples, I think I've tried to show you that this law of creativity has been now seen in the world. See? I always, since about 20 or 30 years, I have always said to my students, I will print any good booklet that would really show how the law of creativity in Christian Science collaborates with the findings in the world. But naturally, this is not very easy to state, but it would be a terrific thing to show to the whole Christian Science field, look here, you make us ridiculous because we say the 7 days of creation are an irresistible creative order. You laugh at it, but the world has got it before you get it. The world has it. The world has accepted it. And to the world we could say, you know, you think that you got something and you are not aware that we got it long before you got it. And we can translate it to a much higher and more important plane, namely how to be creative as a being, how to bring forth your own manhood. Okay.